Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Dr. Monica Williams is a board-certified licensed clinical psychologist who specializes in cognitive behavioral therapies. She's an associate professor in the School of Psychology at the University of Ottawa, Canada Research Chair in Mental Health Disparities, and Director of the Laboratory for Culture and Mental Health Disparities. She's also the clinical director of the Behavioral Wellness Clinic in Toland, Connecticut. Dr. Williams completed her undergraduate studies at MIT and UCLA. She received her doctoral degree in clinical psychology from the University of Virginia. She was an assistant professor at the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine in the Department of Psychiatry for 4 years, where she worked with Dr. Edna Foa, who's a world-renowned expert on OCD and PTSD. She was also a director of the Center for Mental Health Disparities at the University of Louisville. Dr. Williams has published over 100 peer-reviewed articles, book chapters, and scientific reports with a focus on anxiety-related conditions and cultural considerations. She was named one of the top 25 thought leaders in PTSD by PTSD Journal, and she frequently contributes to the public scientific discourse as a media expert. She's been featured on PBS, NPR, The New York Times, and she has a blog on Psychology Today called Culturally Speaking, which is fantastic. You should check it out. She is co-author, along with Daniel Rosen and Jonathan Cantor, of the book Eliminating Race-Based Mental Health Disparities, Promoting Equity and Culturally Responsive Care Across Settings. Her newest book, which we're going to talk all about today, is called Managing Microaggressions, Addressing Everyday Racism in Therapeutic Spaces. Dr. Williams, I'm so happy to have you here today to talk to me about microaggressions, racial trauma, and mental health disparity. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you. I know you're busy and that, you know, this is really important. I think timing, there's a lot of talk right now about these topics. And so I'm very grateful that you're here. I imagine you've been making a number of appearances recently.
I have. It's been like a very crazy busy time right now. Everything that just sort of exploded after George Floyd has really brought a lot of these issues to the forefront. So all of my professional organizations and all the people that I work with and my therapists, my clients, strangers off the street, they all like have questions for me and want me to help in some way, which of course I want to do, but you know, I feel pulled in a lot of directions right now.
I imagine. Yeah. I mean, you've been doing this work for a long time. And I mean, the good news is that all of a sudden, you know, you have a big megaphone.
Yeah. There's a lot of interest right now. I mean, in a way that I've never seen before. I mean, usually when there's, you know, something in the media or, you know, some police violence or something, I'll get, you know, a few calls to do interviews and then it dies down again. But there definitely seems to be some momentum going right now.
Yeah, which is great. And I think today we're going to talk generally about, you know, microaggressions and racism. And we're also going to talk quite a bit about how this shows up in our field of mental health. I want to start, your new book is on microaggressions. And I wanted to just start with a basic kind of understanding of what that means, just for listeners who may not be familiar with that. What are microaggressions?
Microaggressions are small acts of racism. I mean, to put it bluntly, basically, people behave in racist ways that they're not always aware of or conscious of, but the person on the receiving end usually does feel the impact of that in some way. And people who experience microaggressions often spend a lot of time and energy trying to figure out like what the other person meant by their behavior, or like, did they mean to be racist? Do they treat everyone that way? So it can cause people's wheels to spin trying to figure it out and make sense of it. But often the person who commits a microaggression is completely unaware that they've done anything. And this can be a real problem, for example, in therapy sessions where therapists might be committing microaggressions against clients and have no idea.
Yeah, and there, I think, you know, they're insidious and these kind of small exchanges. I get what you're saying, that the emotional energy it takes to kind of think it through and wait, what does that mean? That takes up kind of time and effort for people who receive them.
Yeah, absolutely. It takes up a lot of time and energy. And usually when people of color bring up that they've been microaggressed against, particularly if it's to the perpetrator, the other person quickly denies it. And so then that person's left feeling like gaslit, like, okay, I know something happened and now this person's saying it didn't happen and that I misconstrued it or that I didn't know what I was talking about. So at that point, the person has like two choices to make sense out of what happened. Either the other person did do an act of racism and they're not going to admit it, or they didn't and it was just the victim's fault. So as therapists, we never want to be blaming the victim for things that happened to them. We know how that goes. But unfortunately, that's the experience of so many people of color.
Yeah. And it sounds like it ends up feeling very confusing. You, your book really focuses on racial microaggressions, and that's what we're going to talk about today. Are there other kinds of microaggressions that can happen?
Oh, many kinds of microaggressions. So anybody who has a stigmatized identity can experience a microaggression in line with that identity. So there are LGBTQ microaggressions. There are ableist microaggressions. Those are microaggressions that may be committed against people with disabilities. And gender microaggressions are very common as well.
Yeah, I can think of a few of those I've received.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. What are some of the categories? In your book, you list several. Could you just give a few examples of the categories of microaggressions that you've seen?
Yeah, absolutely. So there's microaggressions where a person's kind of their racial reality is denied. So we might think of these as more like colorblind microaggressions where maybe someone of color is trying to talk about an important racial issue and they're silenced by another person that says, there's only one race, the human race, and I don't see color. And, you know, that's not important. That's one type of microaggression.
If someone says all lives matter, do you think that's a form of that?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, basically saying, you know, I'm trying to make a point that Black Lives Matter, and you're totally negating that by saying all lives matter. That's definitely a microaggression. I mean, and in fact, I don't even call that a microaggression. I just call that racism, because most people who say that, they know, you know, at this point that that's not okay. But yeah, they say it anyway. So I'm not even going to put that in the microaggression category anymore.
Okay. That's just a straight up aggression.
Straight up racist aggression.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Okay. Some other categories?
Yeah. Well, one category that people often don't think about is what we might call an environmental microaggression. And so these are microaggressions that are just sort of, somebody already put something in place that's microaggressive, and we're all just seeing it and experiencing it without anyone having to do anything. So for example, like a Confederate monument, or, you know, a high school mascot that, you know, that has a disrespectful depiction of a Native American. These would be environmental microaggressions. Or even if I'm walking into the medical school and there's a huge hall of framed pictures of all the presidents of the medical school, they're all white men, right? So that's a microaggression too, because that's telling people of color and women that, you know, that these leadership positions are not for you.
There was one of the, I, I got my PhD at Harvard, and there was, I don't know if it's still there. I haven't been there in so many years, but there was a conference room that had all the tenured retired professors. And at the very end, there were one or two women, but it was all white men otherwise.
Exactly. And how did that make you feel seeing that?
I mean, it was, it definitely made me feel like there was this club that it made me feel there's this club that I wasn't a part of, kind of like an outsider. And I mean, it was striking.
Yeah. And yeah. I bet you most of the guys didn't even notice.
Yeah, could be. Yeah.
I bet you most men didn't even notice. And that's the thing about the microaggressions. When you're on the receiving end, boy, you notice. But
yeah.
Yeah.
As a person of color, you've experienced, I'm sure, many of them. And I'm imagining that your personal experience is maybe behind your passion for this work.
I receive microaggressions pretty regularly. I don't know, that it's so much worse than other people of color. We all experience them. But it is part of what motivates me to study it. Honestly, though, I think the main reason that I'm interested in studying it is because it becomes a barrier to care. And so a big thrust of the work that I do is making treatment accessible to everyone. And when people of color go to get help, and if they experience a microaggression, like the first time that they're in the clinic, they're not going to want to come back. And maybe they have something that is very treatable. Maybe we have like a very good short-term CBT approach that could really like eliminate their suffering, but then they just never get it for the rest of their lives because they felt discriminated against when they tried to get help.
Yeah. And I want to talk a bit more about that in the interview, because I think that's really important is how that shows up in mental health. I'm wondering, before we get into that, if you could give us, do you have an example or two of microaggressions that you personally have experienced that you're willing to share with us? I think it makes it more personal if we kind of hear a real life example.
Oh yeah, so many. It's like this. It's so many. It's even like hard to think of one. But I mean, I remember an example where I was invited to give a talk as part of a training for other therapists, and I was all dressed up for my talk, had my briefcase. I was in the elevator, going up to the top floor for the talk. There was another man on the elevator who was similarly dressed. And there was one of the conference organizers in the elevator, and she turned to the white man and said, "Oh, you must be one of the conference speakers." And then proceeded to have a very like engaging conversation with him about how happy she was he was there and what he was going to present. And I was just standing there like, okay. So you didn't think I was a conference presenter, you know?
Yeah, you were just ignored in that conversation.
Yeah, completely ignored. And then starting to feel more and more awkward as I realized that once we get to the top and there's the check-in, this person's going to realize that I'm a presenter too. And she's going to realize that she totally dissed me. And that's going to be awkward too.
Did you say anything?
No, I didn't say anything. Yeah. No, I mean, what am I going to say at that point? Like, hey, you forgot me.
Right. It's so awkward. Yeah.
Yeah. Very awkward.
And I imagine that did not feel good to you.
No, it didn't feel good because it made me feel like, okay, people like me aren't seen as, competent, professional people that educate others.
Yeah. And I think that was another category that shows up often is just making assumptions about people's roles and assuming certain things about their economic status or their professional.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I noticed that when I go out, I feel like I have to look a certain way because if I just go out with scruffy hair and sweatpants, people kind of look at me like they think I'm a criminal, I just don't get treated with respect at all. Yeah. And So even just like the burden of getting ready to leave the house, I have to think about how people may perceive me just on the basis of my race.
Yeah. That illustrates to me as a white woman, I think, privilege because I, go outside in my sweatpants and, ponytail and don't think twice about it. And that's a difference.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, even, places I've lived, I haven't felt comfortable jogging in my neighborhood because I'm worried that someone's going to think I don't belong. And next thing I know, the police or neighborhood watch would be pulling up behind me like, oh, are you lost?
You know? Yeah. Like, which has never happened to me, for the record. Yes. You know, I mean, yeah, that's really,
happened to me.
Yeah. That's powerful to hear about that. Thank you for sharing those examples. So something that in your book I thought was really interesting is just what's behind the microaggressions, because I think, as you said earlier, sometimes they get overlooked and people think, oh, I just, you know, it was a faux pas. It was just a minor mistake. It was no big deal. And he used to say, you know, quote, good people. I say quote because I don't really think people are all good or all bad. But, you know, people who are, they're not like, maybe they even care about racism. They're maybe well-meaning in a lot of ways or whatever, that they can certainly be capable of committing microaggressions. I mean, I'm sure I have, everyone can, but that there are really deeper roots to microaggressions. So can you talk a little bit about intention and, you know, are microaggressions always offensive or can they sometimes just be like no big deal?
Yeah, I mean, that's a good question. And certainly people of color and other people who experience microaggressions, we tend to experience them so much, you kind of learn to shrug them off, but that doesn't mean they're benign. And it doesn't give a pass to people who are doing them, because they can, you know, affect people. They can cause anxiety, depression, sleep problems, and low self-esteem. So they should not be dismissed, even though people who experience them might often say, oh, it's no big deal. It is a big deal. and it is really racism, and intention doesn't matter. And this is, I think, part of the problem is that when white people tend to think about racism, they think of it as intentional acts of harm against people of color. And so if somebody says, hey, you know, what you just said or did there was like a little bit racist, they get very offended because they think that that means they're a reprehensible, hateful person. But the fact of the matter is people are committing microaggressions all the time. They're committing acts of racism all the time, and they often don't know it. So good people can and do commit acts of racism. And so it's important to get past intention, because if you perseverate on intention, you actually never get to the harm that was done, and you can't repair the harm if you get defensive and say, oh, I didn't mean it.
Yeah. And I think it just shuts down the conversation. Like, people want to think, oh, I'm, you know, we like to categorize ourselves or something like, oh, I'm not one of those people who's racist. But when you think of it that way, like this all or nothing thing, you know, either you're doing these like blatant, like right, overt racist or nothing. It's like, there's no room for growth there or to take a look at what's happening.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we, you know, we all make mistakes, and we all need to learn how to move through those mistakes in a functional way.
What are your thoughts about, so let's just say that you're confronted with a microaggression, like someone has the courage to just say to you, hey, you know, you said this, and when you said that, I felt, you know, this way, and that was a microaggression. Like, what would your recommendation be for a better way to respond to something like that?
Yeah, I think that, you know, we actually already have the skill set to respond properly, but, you know, the defenses kick in so fast, we forget to use what we already know. So it's like really basic. You just say, oh, wow, I'm really sorry. I had no idea that that landed on you that way. Can you please, I mean, and if you don't understand why it's a microaggression, say, can you please explain to me why that was racist? It would really help me. I'd really like to know. I don't want to treat you or anybody that way. And, you know, and then just say, oh, thank you. And then move on. You don't want to, the other problem people do sometimes is sometimes they just like keep apologizing forever. And that's no good either, because then that is making the person who experienced the microaggression sort of the emotional caretaker of the person who committed it. And that's not a great place to be in either. So you just want to kind of deal with it just the way you would deal with any other small thing that you did that wasn't very cool. Like if somebody said, hey, you know, you left your backpack in the hall and I tripped over it, it would be the same thing. Like, oh, geez, I'm sorry. I won't do that again. I didn't even realize it was there.
Right. Yeah. You wouldn't keep bringing it up a million times or, yeah. But the acknowledgement, like, I made a mistake. Let me learn something from that. Thank you. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. But the most common response is, oh, I didn't mean it that way at all. Or that's not what I meant. Or even like, how could you say that about me? You know, these defenses.
Yeah. This desire to like explain it and kind of clear your name or something, but right. That doesn't really get you anywhere.
Nope. That doesn't solve the problem. That just probably confirms to the person who experienced the microaggression that you really are prejudiced, and that they can't have a safe conversation with you about these kinds of things.
Yeah. And I think that's so invalidating and gets back to that idea of people feeling gaslit by it. Like, oh no, this is in your head. And I think that's a good segue because I wanted to talk about, you know, I think white people, including mental health clinicians, often sort of underestimate the psychological toll that racism, even these, you know, microaggressions, kind of these day-to-day interactions take on people of color over time. You talked a little bit about this, but can you say a bit more about how these impact people psychologically?
Right. So, you know, so a lot of people, particularly, for example, African Americans, they're often raised in homes where their parents teach them about the realities of racism from an early age to prepare and protect them from what they may experience. But not all families do this. So, and not all kids listen. So, you know, so when young people kind of get out into the world and they start experiencing microaggressions, either they'll recognize them for what they are, like, ah, that's one of those racist things, not about me, or they don't know what to make of it and they internalize it and they're like, oh gee, you know, I find myself like I'm always wrong, I'm always left out of things, people are always looking down on me, there must be something wrong with me. And then that affects a person's self-esteem. They may try to compensate in a lot of ways. They may use harmful ways of coping, like substances or risky behaviors. They may engage in, you know, any number of unhelpful ways to deal with their misinterpretation of all the microaggressions they're experiencing. And that's very problematic for people. They may end up with what we call internalized racism, where they start to believe these negative things about their ethnic racial group, and may even want to distance themselves from that group. They may hate the skin that they're in, try to look different and act differently so that they can feel like they're an exception. And that's mm-hmm. a lot of work.
Yeah, it sounds exhausting.
And you're not going to succeed. You know, if you're Black, nobody's going to be like, okay, so he's got the right clothes and the right car and the right dialect, so we'll just pretend he's not Black. It's not going to happen.
We're thrilled to be partnered with Jill Stoddard. Her fabulous book, Be Mighty, is offering a book club. And what I'm really excited about in terms of the book club is that sometimes I read books, but then I just leave it there and I never actually apply what the book teaches us. And Jill, I think your book club is an opportunity for our listeners to get a really efficient way to start putting those principles into practice. Can you tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah, that's exactly right. So it's through a company called High Tide, and it's a 4-week virtual book club that starts on November 1st. And they're basically bite-sized skills to be able to take what you learn when you read the book and apply it in real life in a really efficient manner. And if you sign up, you get to have 2 live Q&As with me.
That's awesome. And if you go to our sponsorship page on Psychologist Off the Clock, you can get 15% off.
We're also affiliates with Dr. Rick Hansen's online NeuroDharma program and his Foundations of Well-Being programs. And you can find out more about them at our website, offtheclockpsych.com, where you'll get a $40 discount.
A lot of your work is on the lack of access to high-quality mental health care. So here, you know, people are experiencing all this and it does take a toll, but then, you know, it's harder for people of color to have access to quality mental health care, and that's pretty well established. So in your new book, you write specifically about, you know, the microaggressions in therapy and how clinician behavior sometimes has a big consequence in terms of people feeling engaged in therapy. What if we talk more specifically about the context of therapy, what are some of the kinds of things that you see going on that are problematic?
Well, I think the biggest problem is that a lot of therapists don't feel comfortable talking about race, ethnicity, and culture at all. And this is a big problem because a lot of times when people are coming in, they may be coming in because part of what they're dealing with is problems around race or racism, or maybe they're needing to find a way to feel like they fit into Western culture. Maybe their parents are immigrants and their values are confusing and different. Or maybe they have cultural values that are important to them that they want to find a way to hang on to despite maybe pressure to behave in or adopt a more Western way of thinking. So these are some examples of things that clients may be struggling with. And if the therapist can't even talk about these issues with the client in a comfortable way, then they're not going to get their needs met. So that client's going to feel like, well, this person can't help me with what I came in for. And there's no point for them to continue to be seen, or they're going to continue to come, but they're not going to talk about what's really important to them.
Yeah. I guess it seems like maybe, especially if it's a white therapist, that they might avoid it or shut the conversation or just not understand it. I mean, and I know another problem is that there aren't enough clinicians of color to go around. Because one solution is like, okay, find a clinician of color. But that's not always the case. And I don't know.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts around that? Would you recommend?
Well, I think if they're specifically needing to be seen because of issues related to race and culture, I would tend to recommend that they try to find a therapist in their own ethnic group. But we know that because there aren't enough people of color that make it through the psychology pipeline for a whole host of other racist reasons, it's hard to find that person. So every therapist needs to be equipped to work with people in this way. And there are plenty of white therapists who do a great job with clients of color around all of these issues. It's often just a matter of motivation and training. But it can be hard to find them if you're a client, you don't even know what to look for, you know. So I would say like your best bet is to just, if you know, not knowing how to really suss this out as a client, your best bet is to try to find someone from your own ethnic group, or if you can't, just as, you know, somebody of color, hoping that they will have the skills needed to help you. But that's not even a guarantee, because even therapists of color, we're trained in, you know, in very kind of sort of Eurocentric approaches. And so therapists of color may or may not know how to navigate that competently.
Well, and that seems, there's something about that too, that seems like it lets clinicians off the hook a little too easily. If you say, well, just find one of your own background. It's like, yep. No, we need to all be more working toward being more competent. You know, I don't know if we ever really fully get there, but toward being more competent in these areas so that we can provide high quality care to someone who, you know, has a different background than us. Yeah,
absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, you know, it's not going to be long before like America is half people of color. Right now, half of all births are children of color. Half of all children are children of color. So if we want to be able to serve everybody that needs help, we need to know how to work competently with everyone.
Yeah. And as you say, you don't know, you find someone online maybe, or through your insurance or a clinic, you look at their webpage or whatever, you show up, you don't really know until you get there, this person's going to be a good fit, which is always true. But I think especially in the case of this, it's like, you don't really know how the person's going to respond until you start having these conversations.
Yeah.
What recommendations would you have for, you know, mental health providers, especially white ones like myself, who maybe really care about this and want to do whatever we can to improve quality mental health care for people of color?
Yeah, well, I would say step one is going to be sort of a fearless self-assessment to determine if you are comfortable and qualified working with people around these issues. So one of the first things I ask people is, have you had any graduate training? Was there any training offered in your graduate program around culture and diversity? You would hope and think that that would be a no-brainer and the answer would be yes for everyone. It's not.
Disturbing.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I mean, I graduated in 2007 and we didn't have any classes focused on dealing with diverse populations. And it was supposedly integrated into all our classes, which just meant that it wasn't in anything. So so most of the training that I got, I just had to teach myself. And so I know that there's a whole generation of psychologists that didn't get any training. And I know even now, even though it's required, some programs are doing a great job and some programs are not, because I've gotten desperate calls from grad students in other programs begging me to come and do trainings because they're not getting anything. So that's the first question, like, have you had any formal training? And then if not, okay, so what have you done to fill that gap? Have you gone to, you know, workshops? Have you read books? I mean, one lunchtime webinar, that's not gonna make you culturally competent. It's gotta be some ongoing work. And things are changing all the time, so you have to stay on top of things. If you're not doing that, you're already like not qualified to work with people of color competently. And then the next question is, have you done your own anti-racism work? So all of us are steeped in this environment where we're constantly bombarded with racist messages. And if you're not doing anything to actively counter that, then you're ingesting it and you're regurgitating it and it's coming out as microaggressions. So, I would say do your own anti-racism work. And then I would ask people, like, how would you assess yourself just in terms of your own bias against people of color? And one really helpful exercise that I often will give to my graduate students is to make a map, a friendship map of anybody you would go to if you needed help. And on the map, look at all the different dimensions of diversity for those people. If you discover your map is almost all white people, that's a pretty good indication that you've got some bias and you're not learning and growing from people with different perspectives. You're in an echo chamber. So I've had students do this exercise and they find it really enlightening. You know, I've had students, you know, confused, crying, like, why are all my friends white? And I said, don't worry about it. You're not the only one. This is common. This is good that you're recognizing it. I've even had students of color say it, like, or LGBTQ students notice that they've had deficiencies in their friendship map too, that they've wanted to rectify. I had one student who's like, I just realized that all of my friends are atheists, you know, and that person kind of related it back to sort of their own wounding around religious issues when they were young, but at the same time, they were missing that important component of diversity in their lives. So I would say that's like a good start to kind of just do a self-diagnostic. And then some basic practical skills. Can you do a culturally informed case conceptualization? You know, can you comfortably have conversations with other people about racial topics, about racially charged topics, about controversial topics? I mean, if you think about it, as therapists, we're asking people sensitive questions all the time. We're asking them questions about, you know, like sex and if they want to kill themselves and if they've molested children, right? Like, we ask them these questions, like, but it's amazing how many therapists are like, oh, I can't ask them about experiences of racism. Well, yeah, you can, just do it.
Yeah, I love the way you started this. You said, a fearless self-assessment. There is something about this that it's like, you've got to have some courage here, people, you know? I mean, I'm talking about myself too, right? But it's like, you've got to take an honest look at what's happening. You have to go into these places that you may have been kind of conditioned not to go near. But exactly, you have to do that if you're going to be able to do this.
Wow. Exactly. And I think that this is where sometimes our training lets us down, because it's hard to talk to people about sex or suicide or abuse, but we learn to do it because we have to, right? Like, you couldn't graduate from a program if you couldn't ask somebody about thoughts about suicide, and that's uncomfortable, but nobody's holding students accountable to being able to talk to clients about race, ethnicity, and culture.
Yeah. Well, I think that's why this movement that's happening right now is important. I appreciate you doing your part to kind of speak out within the field and more generally about these kinds of things, because it helps. Even just listening to podcasts like this and doing reading, it's all a step in the right direction. So thank you.
You're welcome. Glad to do it.
What recommendations would you have for either listeners who have experienced microaggressions themselves or who want to be helpful to, say, a therapist who wants to be helpful to a client who's experienced microaggressions in terms of how to respond? Like, do they say something or not say something? What are your thoughts around that?
Yeah. So when a client talks about microaggressions they've experienced, the therapist should always believe them and show sympathy and support and validate them. I think it's very tempting in a CBT framework to start doing some questioning around their experiences of microaggressions. And this is absolutely the last thing that a person needs who's experienced a microaggression, because they've already experienced a lot of invalidation. They've already questioned themselves. And they're bringing it up because they've thought about it a lot and they think it might be a real thing. And so the therapist's job is to validate that.
Right. It's not to challenge that thought as you might do in a traditional CBT model. It's like, no, you just validate. Yeah.
Right. Like if a person came and said they'd been raped, you wouldn't ask them 20 questions to see if they had really been raped. You would believe them, right?
Yeah.
So same thing, you're going to believe them and support them.
Okay. And then what about the decision for the person who's been, received the microaggression to speak out or not? What are your thoughts around that?
Well, this is a very, this is a nuanced issue because we know it can be helpful if the person can speak against the microaggression and bring about some positive change, but it's not always safe for them to do so. And that's why microaggressions are perpetuated, because the person who experiences it is disempowered. And so you have to kind of weigh the risk of responding versus not responding. And here's where the therapist can be helpful in looking at and weighing the options and looking at the potential consequences of responding versus not responding, determining if this is a safe situation to do so, or if it's not, or what other options there might be.
Yeah, I think that was something I got out of your book that I found important, is just that sense of safety. And I think sometimes I've heard some stories from my clients where there's a part of me that felt this sense of injustice, and it was easy for me to kind of be like, you got to say something, you have to. And it's not always true, because of even, the psychological safety, even physical safety, even more so, but it's not always, and it puts the responsibility on the person who is kind of the victim of it, if you think of it in that way.
Right. It's totally not fair that the person who is the victim of the microaggression is put in the position where now they have to fix it. And I think that that's important to understand and underscore with clients, even though they may have to be the ones to do that. So, but as a therapist, you want to make sure you understand and appreciate the cost before, encouraging them to push back, because if you don't understand the cost, they're not going to listen to you.
That's right.
So,
and the well-being of the client or the person, who received the microaggression is probably the most important of all.
Yeah. Right. And the person who received the microaggression, they may have other motivations for wanting to push back. Often they might say, well, it's not about me, but I know that this person is hurting others and I don't want them to hurt other people. So I'm willing to put myself out there even at cost if it means that other people will be less likely to suffer.
Yeah. I've had some gender-based conversations with, psychology interns I've trained, where there are maybe other psychologists who have had made some gender-based microaggressions toward them. And the conversation ends up being around, on the one hand, it would be great to say something because the person could learn something from you. But on the other right. hand, you know, the person maybe is going to need a letter of recommendation, or they're going to need to work with this person in the future. And it's a really, it can be just a really hard decision, I think, to, yes. you know, whether they say something or not.
Yeah, exactly. And this is where I think the importance of allies needs to be underscored, because sometimes when people experience microaggressions, they're often not empowered to do anything about it, but there may be allies who can do something about it. And I think that is really critical. So like, let's say, you know, a trainee experiences a microaggression from a faculty member, maybe they're not in any position to do anything, but maybe there would be other faculty who would be allies who could go speak to that person and find a way to try to resolve things.
Absolutely. Yeah. You can kind of help support them and keep them from having to be in that position when they are already like disempowered. Yeah.
Exactly.
So another line of work that you've been really involved in is around racial stress and trauma. And I'm just wondering if you could say, you know, you've done so much work on the impact of racial trauma and on evidence-based practices. I'm just wondering, first of all, if you could just tell us a little bit about what you've seen in your clinical work in terms of the psychological impact of racial trauma.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons I became interested in microaggressions is because they can contribute to racial trauma, which is basically PTSD that results from experiences of racism. And it can be as a result of, you know, one very traumatic racist experience, or more typically a combination of experiences that over time sort of erodes a person's ability to cope. And microaggressions sort of contribute to that. One of the things that we're learning about PTSD is that it tends to be cumulative. Most people who experience a traumatic event don't develop PTSD, but what you find is with people with PTSD have typically had many traumas, and at some point you just are stressed beyond your capacity to manage it, and you tip over from being highly stressed, being traumatized. And so we see the same thing with experiences of racism, that they can accumulate and cause trauma to people. And so that's one of the things that I study is racial trauma. And we see that people have, you know, pretty much all the typical symptoms of PTSD. And, but it often is unrecognized as a form of PTSD, because people have in their mind like what a Criterion A event needs to look like for someone to have PTSD.
Yeah. And I'm thinking of examples like what happened this summer, you know, with George Floyd's murder, and how that impacted people, even just, you know, people who saw the video or who just followed this in the news, and people, Black people, especially people of color, how deeply impacted they were. You know, you might say, oh, well, that doesn't, you know, count as a traumatic event from the traditional DSM if you watch it, but it's traumatic in the same sense. Would you say?
I would say so, because if you watch that video, you see a person murdered in front of your own eyes by powerful people who are supposed to be protecting the public, but you know, at any moment they could come and harass or kill you as a person of color with no consequences. And here someone is just doing it on film because they're that calloused about it. They so believe that they're above the law that they're going to slowly kill someone despite a whole crowd of people protesting saying, stop, he can't breathe. Yeah, that was really traumatic.
Yeah. So it's an example, yeah, of how racial trauma, it's so widespread and needs to be acknowledged.
Yeah. My niece called me in the middle of the night after having seen that video. And she said like she couldn't sleep and she couldn't stop crying because she just couldn't understand why someone would do that to someone else. And every Black person I know has just felt exhausted, just, you know, from that event.
Yeah. I'm curious, you know, when you think about traditional evidence-based approaches to post-traumatic stress disorder, which you are you know, a renowned expert in this area. To me, it feels like there's some shortcomings when it comes to some of those approaches as they're traditionally done when they're applied to racial trauma, one of which is that racial trauma is ongoing. And I think often there's this assumption that it's like a past, like a discrete past event that's over and done with. But with racial trauma, that's not the case. How do you see, like, what are your thoughts around providing effective evidence-based trauma treatments specifically for racial trauma?
Yeah, well, I know that, you know, there's been some concern that's been raised. Well, can we effectively treat people for this if we're going to treat them and we're just going to throw them back into a racist society? Because normally when you do PTSD treatment, for example, if somebody is experiencing domestic abuse, you would want them to get out of that before you would treat them for the trauma. But, you know, we can't really, you know, extricate people from the racist society. And it doesn't seem to be socially just to say, sorry, we can't treat you because we can't change society. So you're on your own. That doesn't seem right or fair. So my hope is that by treating people, yes, it's true that we can't, you know, they're going to go back out to a racist civilization. But hopefully, like PTSD, a lot of times there are maladaptive cognitions that maintain the trauma. There's avoidances that maintain it. Certainly, some of the avoidances may be adaptive, but oftentimes they've generalized to things that are not dangerous. So we're going to do the same kinds of treatment in that respect, in terms of helping people think differently about themselves and the world, and stop avoiding. But it might be different from treatment for traditional PTSD, and that we're going to also spend a lot of time, you know, validating them and their experience of racism. They know that racism's not going to go away, but maybe they can find different ways of managing it when it does. One of the most typical types of racial trauma I see is people who got traumatized in the workplace. And often they don't want to leave their jobs, not because they can't find another job, but because they don't want to let the haters win, which I understand. And I hate letting haters win too. But I tell people, you know, look, as your therapist, my concern is your mental health above anything else. And this environment is toxic for you and you need to get out of it. So part of it is going to be like strategizing an exit plan. And finding a place where, yes, you're not going to be free from racism, but you don't need to be experiencing this level of it. And also building up their support system around this so that they have more resources and coping for stressors as they come. So, you know, so I like for clients to have kind of a self-care plan that involves people they can talk to who are safe and supportive when issues of racism come up. Options for them to get away and relax. And we have to think carefully about this too, because what might be relaxing for a white person might not be relaxing for a black person, you know. So I might want to, for my white clients, I might want to recommend they go to a yoga class. For my black clients, they might not feel relaxed in a room full of white women. So I might think about something else that would be relaxing for them.
Yeah. Well, thank you. I mean, I think this is something I've been kind of grappling with in my own work, is like how to both validate the experience and help the person with their struggles, you know, to kind of help them move forward, you know, understand their emotional experience, move forward in whatever way they see fit. And sometimes it kind of feels like hard to walk that line between the two.
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I think it can be done. And, you know, I think with more practice and I think it helps to recognize that, you know, when we're working with racism, there's kind of a bunch of additional considerations that we need to pay attention to that wouldn't necessarily be the case for maybe some or most of the people that you might be seeing.
Yeah. Well, and I think that I appreciate earlier in the conversation you mentioned doing anti-racism work and that kind of thing too, because it seems like as, you know, as mental health professionals, we are both working with the individual who's sitting in front of us, but we also do need to take a look at the bigger systemic issues that are playing a role here. And sometimes it feels a little like, what can I possibly do? It's so big. But I think if we all do what we can.
Yeah, maybe. I think psychologists are in a really good position potentially to bring about change in this area, because if you think about it, you know, we're the ones that get all the training on people's behaviors and how to change behaviors and how people think about the world. I mean, if you think about it, most of the country is run by lawyers, right? So I don't know how many lawyers you know, but
quite a few. You know,
but if you think about it, are those the people you want shaping our society, right? Most psychologists, like if you ask them if they think they're qualified to run for public office, most of them will say no. They don't think they are, which I think is astounding, because I think we know far more about human behavior than lawyers do, and we know how to understand research. So I think we have a huge potential to make a difference in the world. And you might have heard of different types of training models for psychologists. Like, I know there's a scientist practitioner model. I know that there's some psychologists who are interested in creating like a new model, which might be like a science practitioner activist model, which I think is so much needed, because I think we have the potential to be big agents for change.
Yes, well, thank you, because I do think you're right. Like, we have an understanding of this and a way of maybe having conversations about it that is unique, and that we can maybe do more than we think we can toward
exactly
affecting these bigger changes.
Right. Because I mean, no matter how little you think you know as a psychologist, I guarantee you know more than a lawyer. So about
good
human
point
behavior anyway.
Yes, that is true. That is true. And that is reassuring. Well, Dr. Williams, I am so grateful again for the conversation today. I've learned a lot from your work and from this conversation, and I really appreciate your time. Thank you so much for joining me today.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much.
And how can people find you who want to learn more?
It's super easy. They can follow me on Twitter at Dr. Dr. Monica with two N's. Or you can go to my website, which is monicawilliams.com. And again, great, that's Monica with two N's.
Great. Thank you very much for joining us.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure.